Well, good morning. If you want to go ahead, grab your Bibles, open up to Psalm 120. Psalm 120 this morning. As you're turning there, tell me if you've had this experience, maybe even during these weeks and weeks of quarantine, where you're in your basement or storage room or something like that, and you go to reach for something off a shelf, and you're trying to pull it out, and the whole shelf comes down on top of you, all the stuff that's been shoved in over the years, and you just think, you know what, that's it. We've got a project for the weekend. We are cleaning, we are organizing this room. Or maybe on a more serious scale, you're driving into work or something and you feel something off in your heart and you just can tell, and you pull into the nearest hospital and get the diagnosis, and from that point on, diet and exercise look very, very different in your life. It's an experience we have a lot, where there's some challenge or crisis, some shove that pushes us in a direction where we say, enough, enough, okay? Things are going to be different from here on out. Now, we're starting a new series this morning in Psalms. And why? Why would we study Psalms? Why now? Well, Psalms are gritty. They're real. That's why I love them. They pull at the tension between what we know as Christians and what we feel. Those times when how we expect things to go based on our theology just doesn't seem to add up exactly. Josh Moody, pastor at College Church just down the road here, says it like this. He says, Psalms are a God-designed tool to help us feel truly the truth. Psalms say things we would rarely say out loud in church, but then people feel things they would rarely say out loud in church. We need somewhere to go to process those emotions, to inspect them in the light of God, I love that, by the way, and bring them into line with His will and His way. Or John Calvin, one of the great theologians of history, calls Psalms an anatomy of all the parts of the soul. And he goes on to say that there's no emotion not here represented as in a mirror. We are on display in the Psalms, all that goes on inside of us. And most of the Psalms are intensely personal. It's written by a real person who's going through some real stuff, which we'll see in our psalm this morning, in fact. But at the same time, they voice universal human experiences and emotions, including, and it's going to be important for us in a moment, homesickness, that longing for the world we were created to live in God's presence. So we're going to look in our series here at the Songs of Ascents, Psalms 120 to 134. And if you look at those psalms, you'll see at the top the superscription, and we'll say a Song of Ascents above each of those. It's kind of an odd superscription, odd little title, but most likely what this is referring to, most scholars would agree, these were songs that were sung by pilgrims as they ascended to Jerusalem for the various religious festivals that took place in Jerusalem, like the Passover. Jerusalem's pretty high up in the mountains, but also just because of its importance, you go up to Jerusalem. That's just what you do. And so that's why they were called Songs of Ascents. You get this impression because of the 15 Psalms, 14 of them refer to Zion or Jerusalem or the city, which would be talking about Jerusalem as well, the temple, which is in Jerusalem or something like that. So they show up in every single psalm except for today's, actually, and we'll see why in just a moment, but that's because it has more to do with the starting point rather than the destination. But you get the impression then that with all these references to Jerusalem, that these psalms have this laser focus on the destination. They're not overly concerned with the stops along the way. And I think that's important because that means that these psalms speak to all circumstances. We don't have to say, well, I went a different route, so this doesn't really apply to me. Because the focus is on the destination and the mere fact of the journey, it speaks to us wherever we are, and speaks especially to those of us who are pilgrims living in exile. In fact, a lot of these psalms come from the time when Israel, Judah is coming back from life in exile in Babylon, and almost certainly these psalms were sung then. So there is, in these 15 psalms, a longing for home, that homesickness I was talking about earlier. Almost nobody speaks of that longing for home more profoundly and with more insight than a C.S. Lewis. And he writes at one point, "The human soul was made to enjoy some object that is never fully given, nay, cannot even be imagined as given in our present mode of existence. This world is not our home. It is not enough. We really are exiles, citizens of heaven, living in a foreign land." And so it's no surprise then that we begin our pilgrimage in a distant land, setting out for what will feel like home. Now, look, there is a tension, though, because, of course, while we are exiles, pilgrims, if we belong to Christ, this world is not our home. We were born as natives in exile. We were children of the world to begin with. And so it'd be a little bit like those Israelites who were born in Babylon during exile, where there's this pull to go, well, yeah, but I kind of grew up here. I know the neighborhood. I like it. And yet this longing for home at the same time. So what will it take to get us to the point where we're willing to leave and to set out on this pilgrimage? Because to start the pilgrimage, to set out on the journey, is to say goodbye to what feels like home, even if it's temporary. It is the end of an era. Eugene Peterson, in his book on the Songs of Ascent, Along Obedience the Same Direction, which I would highly recommend, writes this. He says, "A person has to be thoroughly disgusted with the way things are to find the motivation to set out on the Christian way." I'll come back to that quote later because I think it's so important. We have to be thoroughly disgusted with the way things are in order to be willing to set out on our journey. And that's what we're exploring in this first Song of Ascents. And I think it's very timely. Look, I picked this series earlier. We'd planned to do this long before coronavirus hit, but I think this is really apropos given the current climate. This crisis might be that shove that we need that helps us to set out on the pilgrim way. And that's going to follow the pattern that I started with, where there's some challenge, some crisis, some shove that leads us to face a choice and then hopefully make the change. So we'll take those one at a time. So first of all, the challenge. What is that crisis? What is that shove? Let me read verses 1 and 2. Psalm 120, verses 1 and 2. "I call on the Lord in my distress, and he answers me. Save me, Lord, from lying lips and from deceitful tongues." So what challenge does the psalmist face? What prompts his reflection? What's the catalyst that gets him to set out on his journey? Well, it's one we have probably all faced if you're lived for any number of years on the planet. It's lying lips and deceitful tongues. He is a victim of slander, of gossip, of a smear campaign waged against him. And so this is intensely personal. He's a real person. Real people are spreading lies about him, but it's also a nearly universal experience. It's the sort of thing that happens, starting in about middle school or so, certainly by high school. You find friends sharing stories about you behind your back, and all of a sudden you discover that you're outside the clique that you used to be a part of. It happens at work, especially at transition points like layoffs. Well, you know why Bob got fired, didn't you? It happens at church. In fact, you may be watching now carrying hurt with you, either from this church or from a previous church. Maybe you left because of these sorts of things. Christians are notoriously guilty of gossip and slander to our shame. It happens even in families where relationships are fractured over time. And it draws out, of course, the overwhelming power of words. The tongue has the power of life and death, to hurt or to heal, Proverbs says. It means we can put to bed once and for all what is probably the dumbest nonsense ever uttered by humanity. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Like, that is just utter nonsense. As Proverbs says, Proverbs 12, verse 18, the words of the reckless pierce like swords, far worse than sticks or stones. James calls the tongue a restless evil, full of deadly poison, and describes how just a single word is like a small spark that can burn down your whole life. And you can watch this play out in real life. You know, a young girl who has a rumor started about her, about what happened on a date or something like that, loses a whole set of friends, branded for the rest of her days with some ugly words, and can lead ultimately, and has sadly, to suicide at its extreme. One spark burning down a whole life. And that's where our psalmist is when he writes this psalm. He's on the brink. He's despairing. He feels trapped in this web of smears. What will he do? William Blake, in his collection of children's poems, Songs of Innocence and Experience, and they're children's poems but have profundity in them, he writes this at one point. He says, I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And that's kind of where our psalmist is. Which way is he going to go with the anger that he feels within him? Because there's this great danger with strong emotions. Anger is certainly probably chief among them, but other emotions also. Emotions are God-given. They're like warning lights on the dashboard. You know, the check engine light comes on, and the thing to do is to pull over, pop the hood, and figure out what exactly is going on. We have a friend, Amy and I, who the check engine light came on when they were on the highway, and they thought, you know what, I'm just going to go until I get to my destination, and then I will figure out what is happening, and kept ignoring all the blinking lights and things like that. And at the exit ramp at 88 in Winfield, her car burst into flames. She was unharmed, thankfully. The car did not survive, however, but that's a good picture of what happens when we leave our emotions unchecked, when we don't pop the hood and figure out what's going on inside. Now, no doubt, with all this anger here, our psalmist is tempted to start his own smear campaign. I mean, if you've been here, if you've experienced, you know how strong that temptation is. But he chooses a better way. Instead of replying to his assailants, instead of replying to these harsh words and answering back with his own harsh words, he speaks to God. He speaks to God. He processes his emotions in God's presence before God, and he receives a better answer. What's so interesting, of course, is that he's still in the midst of these circumstances. The psalm doesn't say, and you delivered me out of them. And now these people aren't saying this. The truth has come to light. It just says, I call on the Lord my distress, and he answers me. And then he makes his petition at that point. So he's still in the midst of these hard circumstances, but he's received the assurance of faith. And what assurance is that? It's God's character, specifically the assurance, the reminder of who God is. God's name, the Lord, here shows up just twice in the psalm, and it's right here in verses 1 and 2. I call on the Lord. Save me, Lord. And that's the divine name when it's in all caps like that, Yahweh. With all that the divine name implies, when God reveals himself to Moses, I am who I am. No name can contain me because I am who I am. I will always be who I am now. And part of that includes the fact that he's attentive to our cries, which we see here in verses 1 and 2. He's able to save. We're going to see that he is just and good as we continue through the rest of the psalm as well. And we have the same confidence when we approach God because we know that he is unchanging as well. Though all else changes around us, God is still the same. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But think of why this matters at a moment like this, to remember the character of God. John Bailey, whose Diary of Private Prayer is just a treasure of classic Christian works, writes this at one point. He says, "I'm sure that the bit of the road that most requires to be illuminated is the point where it forks." That's the point where our psalmist is. Do you see, God's glory is that flash of lightning that illuminates the fork in the road. This is why I think Proverbs speaks of the fear of the Lord, that awe at who he is, as the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. It's what you need to know in order to make the right decision, choose the right path. Now, you might not be the victim of a smear campaign, but you're facing challenges, because we always are facing challenges, and we're in a challenging time with this pandemic. So you could be facing economic challenges, with lost wages or maybe a lost job, relational challenges, just the tension and stress bubbling up, and it comes out in places like marriages. I don't think I've talked to anyone who has said their marriage hasn't gotten a little bit snippier in these last 10 weeks when we've been cooped up at home. And if you think that's not true, I'd like to talk to your wife. She might have a different answer for you. We're facing health challenges as well. We had some neighbors, for example, who had a COVID scare this week, where one of their kids spiked a fever up over 104. And look, it's terrifying. Had this not been going on, it probably wouldn't have been as big a deal, just a little more Motrin. But in the midst of all this, it's terrifying. So when this challenge comes, the question is, will you admit God? Like a judge allowing some new bit of evidence to shift your whole understanding of what transpired, what is transpiring. Will you let God's glory be like that lightning flash so that you can see which path to choose? And let's see how the psalmist works this out now that the lightning has a flash. As we get to the choice, we keep reading verses 3 and 4. "What will he do to you, and what more besides, you deceitful tongue? He will punish you with a warrior's sharp arrows, with burning coals of the broom bush." Now, there is an ambiguity in these verses that the NIV obscures. I love the NIV. It's my favorite translation. I've got no patience for those ESV thumpers. I'm just kidding. I love the ESV, too. I think the two should be read in tandem. But we use the NIV here for good reason, and it's a good translation. But if I have one critique of the NIV, it's that it does sometimes try and clarify what I think should remain ambiguous, like here. So verse 4, it doesn't actually say, "He will punish you with." It just starts with "a warrior's sharp arrows." What will he do to you? And what more besides, you deceitful tongue? "A warrior's sharp arrows, with burning coals of the broom bush." So what exactly does that verse 4 mean then, since we don't actually get any explanation about what it's referring to? Now, most take it the way the NIV translates it here, and I think that's fine. They take it to be prophetic denunciation. So this is a little bit like Habakkuk detailing Babylon's destruction when God metes out his judgment, and certainly that happens. My only hesitation with thinking that that's what's really going on here, or that's the whole of what's going on here, is that it assumes that the psalmist has the detached perspective of a prophet, so that he can speak with righteous anger. It is so very, very difficult to get to righteous anger when you are the one being wronged. Like many of us, because of what's been going on in the country this week, have felt truly righteous anger at injustice. But when it happens to you, that's much harder to come by. This is why James says, for example, be slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. So look, I've been in a similar situation to what's going on here in this psalm, and I can tell you that I assumed a moral clarity that I did not actually possess. I had been blinded by my anger. I was praying the psalms a whole lot at the time, and thankfully, after about 3 years of praying the psalm, came to the conclusion that my anger was not entirely righteous, not even close. So that's my only hesitation with thinking this is purely prophetic denunciation. Certainly there's some element of prediction baked into this. This is just a simple, you know, actions have consequences sort of declaration, like you might read in Proverbs, "the mouth of a fool invites ruin," that kind of thing. Most likely. I think the psalmist he's just pouring out his rage. I'm not sure this rises too far above the level of you'll get what's coming to you. He doesn't even know how exactly. Maybe it's God going to mete out perfect justice. I don't think he's thinking that clearly. You can almost see him holding his bow in his hands, the arrows on the table before him. He's looking at the charcoal burning in the hearth before him. And by the way, the charcoal from the broombrush tree was famous for burning for a long time. So he's expecting his rage to smolder for a good long period. But as he holds that bow in his hands, that's his choice. Will he take vengeance himself, which he knows is forbidden by the God he worships, or will he leave it in God's hands? The key for us as we apply this to our lives today is that he takes it to God. He takes that choice to God. He wrestles with his anger, with his desire for vengeance in God's presence, and he says it out loud to God. Probably eye-opening for him to say it. I don't know if you've ever prayed honestly. It can be eye-opening. Certainly it can be eye-opening for us as we read him working through this in God's presence. But it's got a wider application than this one setting. This isn't just about vengeance. At its root, the question really is who or what will say? I mean, that's what he prayed, right? Verse 2, save me, Lord. All right, well, how's that going to happen? Do I call out to God in my distress, lean on him, trust him for deliverance? Or do I take matters into my own hands, whatever that looks like? What will keep you from setting out on the pilgrim way? From marching toward Zion and the promised land is not the challenges you face. No. Not at all. It's your response to them. That's the choice, right? That's the moment where we decide. So here's Eugene Peterson. Here's the quote I mentioned earlier. Let me read it, but I'm going to keep reading for him. A person has to be thoroughly disgusted with the way things are to find the motivation to set out on the Christian way. As long as we think the next election might eliminate crime and establish justice, or another scientific breakthrough might save the environment, or another pay raise might push us over the edge of anxiety into a life of tranquility, we are not likely to risk the arduous uncertainties of the life of faith. A person has to get fed up with the ways of the world before he acquires an appetite for the world of grace. So the psalmist cradles his bow, stokes the coal fires of his rage. Does it depend on him? So he got to take matters in his own hands. Does he go to a judge and start this whole process? What does he do with it? Even now, in this pandemic, in whom or what do we trust? In a vaccine, which sounds amazing, by the way, that our government leaders will make the right decisions all the times, another stimulus check, wearing a mask in public. I mean, look, those are all good things. Like, I'm looking forward to a vaccine. I really am. It's like longing for justice in this world, like the psalmist is longing for here. Like, absolutely, and we work for justice in this world, but you can't live there. You can't build your house there in that hope. It's like building your house in a floodplain. Like, it's lovely. You know, you're right there on the riverbank and stuff. It's gorgeous. It's lovely right up until it's not. Right up until the flood comes. And then it's a pretty foolish place to have staked your hope. Like, a vaccine is great right up until, you know, the next disease hits. Or even if no disease ever hits, old age will still take us. You can't put your hope there. And this is not just for anger, not just for crises. This is for every area of our lives. In what or whom do we trust? Like, maybe you're there right now, and especially in a period of isolation, you're cradling your loneliness in your hands. He's saying, I got to deal with this. I got to fix this. I got to find a way to feel loved. Maybe you're looking to illicit means like casual sex or pornography, thinking that that'll numb that feeling. Of course, it won't work. Or maybe it's an illicit relationship in the sense that you're looking to somebody that you know you shouldn't marry because the most important part of you, your union with Christ, isn't something that they share. Or maybe it's more illicit means. Maybe you're looking just to marriage or friendship or something like that, but you can't put your hope there because marriages still have problems. I got news for you. Talk to some married people. They probably still feel with struggles, struggle with feeling unloved at times. If we're going to set out, we got to get fed up with this world and to look elsewhere for salvation. Instead of building our home in a floodplains, we gotta look for a city with foundations, like Hebrews says, for that promised land, for that future Zion. There is the choice that the challenge prompts. Even now, every one of us holds some sort of bow in our hands. In whom or what will we trust? It leads us to the change, the hard choice that hopefully we will make. Let me finish out the psalm, read verses 5-7 for us. Woe to me that I dwell in Meshech, that I live among the tents of Kedar. Too long have I lived among those who hate peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Now, verse 5 is the whole reason that this psalm is used here in this collection of pilgrimage psalms, because it's the setting out point for that pilgrimage. He's saying, I am dwelling in Meshech, in Kedar. And the key to understanding this, by the way, is to realize where those places are. I know what happens when we read place names in the Old Testament. We just go, I don't know how to pronounce those, and I don't know where they are, so I'm going to assume they're not important. They just might be important. This is why a good study Bible with some maps in it can be really, really helpful. Well, Meshech is in modern-day Turkey, in Asia Minor there. And Kedar is in Arabia. So you couldn't actually live in both places at the same time. Like, they're not that close together. In fact, they're on opposite sides of Israel. So unless he's got a summer home in one of these or something like that, I don't think he's talking about these places literally. This is a figurative use. He's saying, I'm dwelling as an exile in a culture that is hostile to God's kingdom. I'm living in the world, in other words. In this case, he feels that because he's living among a people who don't love peace, who hate peace, in fact. And that Hebrew word peace, shalom, is so important. It means more than just the absence of conflict. It's the presence of justice. It's an integrated life. It's one that's oriented around God, His glory, lighting the way for our pilgrimage. So it's at this moment that our psalmist makes his choice and embraces the hard change, lays down the bow and the burning coals and self-determination and worldly ways. I am for peace, he says. I am for peace, even if they're for war. He chooses, it would seem, I'm reading between the lines a little bit, but I think it's clear. He chooses silence in the face of slander. Like Jesus would later on. Here's Peter. Of course, Peter is writing to the exiles dispersed in all these different foreign cultures. And he writes this, 1 Peter 2, 21-23, to this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. That's the pilgrimage right there, by the way. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Don't need to answer a smear campaign with slander of my own. Don't need to take vengeance in my own hands. I can entrust myself to God. It's not an easy choice, but it's the one that our psalmist makes. And of course, he doesn't even have the example of Jesus. He simply has the character of God. And yet it is enough to entrust himself to that God. Not an easy choice, though. I mean, he may have suffered irreparable harm to his reputation. He may have lost relationships that he will never regain. But nevertheless, in the words of the pagan philosopher Mencius, before a man can do things, there must be things he will not do. And that's what our psalmist has decided. This is his drawing a line in the sand moment. And it's a moment we must come to as well. To follow God is to say no to some things so that you can say yes to better things, to a true and lasting joy. This is like Abraham saying no to Ur, to his people and his culture, so that he could say yes to Canaan. This is like Israel saying no to Egypt, which, granted, they were in slavery, but you listen to them in the wilderness, and there were some comforts in Egypt. They longed for those cucumbers and leeks that they used to have. But no, you got to say no to Egypt in order to say yes to the promised land. Although there's a wilderness journey to get there, an important reminder for us. So this is like Jesus himself. When Satan tempts him and offers him all the kingdoms of the world without the cross, without the pain and suffering, if he'll just bow down and worship Satan. And so Jesus saying no to those kingdoms, saying no to glory without the cross, without suffering, and saying yes to the joy set before him, the salvation of many. Each no set them on a journey to the promised land, to Calvary, but the glory road beyond it. And here, too, it seems. This is really the main idea. Like, if I could get us going in this series, here's the takeaway from this psalm. So we're in the series going up, right? We're ascending. We are marching toward Zion, the promised land, toward glory. You need to set out to go up. Just nice and simple. You actually got to leave if you want to make that pilgrimage. And so it starts with that first step, although it's the most difficult one. Like a lot of us, we think of conversion as arrival, but it's not. Conversion is our departure. That moment when we first yield to Christ is when we set out on our pilgrimage, like Christian in Pilgrim's Progress, where the book starts with him leaving the city of destruction. That's us as we answer the question posed to us by those great theologians, the Clash, all those years ago. Should I stay or should I go? That's the question we have to answer. To set out on a journey is to leave the comforts of home, like Frodo leaving the comforts of the Shire. And it is a true quest, by the way, just as exciting as his. Because the start of a new way of life is the end of an old way of life. So we gotta make that shift from apathy to action, from resting content with our sin, and moving towards godliness and Christlikeness. Our first step on the journey of faith, of course, looks like this. And some of you tuning in, like, this may be you. You may not believe. You may still be asking questions about Jesus, about Christianity. And this is what it would look like for you then to say, you know what, I'm going to start that journey today. So yes, it's that first step on the journey of faith. But can I tell you something? It is every subsequent step on the journey of faith as well. Like, the journey of faith is nothing but forks in the road. Every single step we take, we have the opportunity to follow in the path that God has set before us, or to turn to our own ways. Like Isaiah said, each of us has turned to our own ways, like sheep that go astray. So nothing but forks in the road. And so every fork, every temptation, we must meet with this same resolve that the psalmist has here. Too long have I lived here. Too long have I lived here. You know what? I'm fed up. I'm disgusted with this way of life. I am setting out again. I'm going to keep walking to glory. So some challenge goads us to act at last, to face this choice before us with gospel eyes and to make the hard change. The pandemic has given us this crisis. The pandemic has taken a jackhammer to so many of our life's foundations. And so we've discovered that many of us have built our house at least partially on sand. And that's a good thing that we've learned this, because we can now choose to build on solid rock instead, on Christ and the word of God. What does that look like? What might this look like, this challenge choice change as it plays out in pandemic? Well, one challenge we face is the economic disruption that has happened and will continue. And so there's the choice before us, the fork in the road. Do we choose our own security, or do we choose sacrificial generosity, trusting in God for our daily bread? And so maybe the change is that we decide to invest in what cannot be lost. We will invest in eternity and not trust this world's comforts. Or look, one challenge that we're facing is the death of loved ones, the potential death of loved ones. And the way this virus works out, by the way, means that if they get sick unexpectedly, it happens, it goes quickly, we may not get to speak to them again. That's how this plays out. There's going to be no deathbed conversation because we can't be in the room, and it'll be on a ventilator, and they'll be sedated at that point anyway, so we can't visit them. And that's hard. Like, some of us have family, for example, that they don't know Jesus yet. And so we got a choice. There's that fork in the road. Do we choose relational comfort? We're not going to rock the boat. Or do we choose winsome boldness in light of the gospel urgency before us and embrace the hard change of sharing the gospel? Like, some of us should probably leave this sermon and just pick up the phone and say, you know what? I got to say some things to you now, just in case I can't say them to you later. Or we're facing the challenge of isolation and the uncertainty of the future. And so, well, we got a choice before us. We can retreat inward and just keep building those walls ever higher, or we can embrace community. We can reach out and say, you know what? This has shown me that I need people in my life to encourage me, to hold me up, to speak truth to me. And so maybe embracing the hard change here just looks like shooting me an email saying, you know what? It's time. I'd like to get connected to a community group. I'd like to get plugged into a journey group. I know I need people around me. I know that more than ever before. Or maybe the challenge is just as simple as you're hearing a sermon on Psalm 120. And the Spirit is wielding the word of God like a scalpel in your heart right now. And the choice before you is to persist in hidden sin or to repent. Too long have I lived here. And so embracing change looks like confession, getting the help you need in obeying God. I don't think it's any secret, if you've been tuning into my preaching for any length of time, that my favorite quote, the one I return to most often outside of the Bible, is on page one of Augustine's Confessions. You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in you. We long for home. We long to find rest in God's presence. Ultimately, what will get us to set out is when we acknowledge that restlessness, when we acknowledge that there are desires within us that nothing in this world can satisfy, because everything in this world is built in a floodplain. And so we get fed up with the imitation, and we choose the genuine article instead. We seek lasting joy. Too long have I lived apart from God. This world in its current form is not my home, and I don't want to live in exile any longer. And so we set out. And the really good news, of course, is that this pilgrimage follows a well-worn path. Hebrews 12 tells us that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses who've already reached the finish line. And so we can run with endurance the race set before us. This is like setting out from Mount Katahdin on the Appalachian Trail, knowing that you will meet people who have done the trail already. They have gone before. They wait to welcome you at the end. And the really, really good news is that we can look to the one who blazed that trail. Hebrews 12 goes on to call Jesus the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. So he's the one who blazed this pilgrimage trail. Because he was exiled not just in Kedar or Meshach. He was exiled to Hades itself. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. We've got our own little pilgrimage going. But God has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And so he bore that punishment. He bore our exile. He was not only left glory to come and live among us, but was then cast out. I mean, he was crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem. He was crucified outside Zion, the city to which we march. Why? So that the gates would be open for us when we get there. When we get there. And I want to just close with this reminder that this pilgrimage to Zion, to glory, it will be a long and arduous journey. Again, read Pilgrim's Progress if you haven't, especially everyone should have read this book. I can't say that strongly enough. Read Pilgrim's Progress just to get a sense of how long and difficult the journey may be. In fact, even our journey here, like we got 14 more weeks in this series. It's a long series for us because it's a long pilgrimage. One of the greatest challenges to discipleship today, to becoming like Jesus in our culture, is that we live in a culture of instant everything. We're a microwave culture, and discipleship is a marinating culture. So the challenge is what Gore Vidal called today's passion for the immediate and casual. That is how we approach discipleship, and that is not going to work. We're going to need what Nietzsche referred to as that long obedience in the same direction. That is the path of discipleship. It leads to glory, but we got to set out if we're going to get there. Are you ready to set out? Are you ready for that long obedience in the same direction? Let's pray. Lord, help us even now to take maybe the first step in this pilgrimage. Maybe just another step in the pilgrimage. I know that we're all at a fork in the road because every moment of every day is a fork in the road where I can choose to live for myself and go my own way, or I can live for you and follow the path that Christ has already laid down for us, that he himself tread, pioneering this trail, blazing it for us. Lord, help us to become fed up with the ways of this world and frankly with our own ways. Help us to become disgusted enough, maybe even in the challenges we're facing in this pandemic, so that we're willing to set out, to make the choice, to embrace the change. Maybe it's choosing to remain silent in the face of slander, but it might be something else entirely different. Whatever challenge we face, Lord, help us to choose well as we look to your glory revealed at Calvary on the cross and in the empty tomb. Let that glory light up our path so that we step well, and help us to keep going, Lord, to persist as we march toward our heavenly reward, as we seek your face, as we seek the lasting joy that comes from knowing you and knowing you alone. We ask this through Christ our Lord. Amen. All right, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back next week as we take the next psalm in the Songs of Ascent, Psalm 121.